Exorcism, from the Greek exorcismos, defined as binding by oath, is the religious or spiritual practice of purportedly evicting demons or other spiritual entities from a person or an area that is believed to be possessed. Depending on the spiritual beliefs of the exorcist, this may be done by causing the entity to swear an oath, performing a ritual, or simply commanding it to depart in the name of a higher power. The concept of possession is older than any of the Judeo-Christian religions. The idea of a presence hijacking a body is in the Kabbalah, the collective text that served as the blueprint for theology's framing creation. Some of the elements were integrated into Judaism and from the Torah to the Bible. Now, my natural impulse as a skeptic is to assume accounts of pre-biblical people behaving unlike themselves are everything from attention-seeking to mental illness. Maybe that young woman coming into her own makes you feel uncomfortable. Maybe that child's behavior doesn't suit your needs. Did the devil make them do it? In The Exorcist, Father Marin tells the doubting Father Karras that the target of the possession is not Reagan, but to see ourselves as animal and ugly, to reject the possibility that God could love us. Now, maybe there is a point where mortal sciences will fail us. When a nightmare trapped in a person can no longer be explained as the duality of man, and at that point, we might be grateful that there are millennia-old traditions that are ready to fight our fight with us.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. The Rance Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
As it happens, sometimes these episodes run long, and so we've decided to turn this into a two-parter, starting with 2012's The Possession, and closing out with 1973's The Exorcist. So entering into the research stage for this show,
yes.
I was pretty surprised that there are entries for any number of religions and cultures for exorcisms
that
and possession,
true.
Really.
Well, people love to explain someone's bad behavior.
Right.
You know?
It's funny, yeah, towards the end of this, I've got an entry that, like, none of these things are recognized under the DSM-5. Like,
yeah.
There is no... They're all accounted to, like, mania and hysteria.
Right. Melancholy, one of my favorite Elizabethan England things that many people suffered from.
Nice. It's ennui.
Melancholy and hysteria.
But the spookier, more interesting stuff comes from texts as old, like, that predate the Bible. We're
right.
talking, like, the Kabbalah on which, like, Judaism took its notes from and incorporated some elements, but not all.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of Jewish mysticism, it even documents cases of possession from back then. And enough so that they had a routine reaction. Like, there's
yes.
there's a plan. Like, if someone seems to have someone else inside them, then, like, you call these people and they go into action because... Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty cool that I guess this is the version of, like, community outreach back then.
Yeah, I guess.
And trying
task force.
To, like, yeah, trying to, yeah. like, you know, bring someone back to normal, you know? They'd probably take offense to being called witch doctors, but, like,
yeah.
they're all serving the same purpose.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, it gets a little shady when you start to read accounts, like, later, in especially even the modern-day exorcism, where it just seems like, oh, it's an excuse for ladies be crazy, and I want to fix that. And so, like, it gets a little like, oh, that's not nice. You're not nice people. Exorcists are not nice people, right? But it's neat to think about the old, old bits of it. The thing that's kind of crazy is this idea of using demons to explain, like, bad shit.
Yeah, yeah,
you
the
know.
Devil made me do it.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And if we want to take it from an exorcist from a Christianity and then later into, like, a Catholic kind of point of view, we look at the Old Testament, same as Hebrew Bible, right? And there are demons, but not a lot of times do we talk about possession in the Old Testament.
Mm.
Really, possession starts coming in the New Testament for the most part.
Okay.
We only have in the whole thing 14 accounts of people being possessed.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it more in depth in terms of the movie The Possession,
right.
But the concept of the Dybbuk goes back to the Kabbalah, and this isn't a demonic presence. This is essentially a lost soul.
Yeah, and it literally means to cling.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like that idea, but originally introduced as a neutral kind of entity. Could be good, could be bad, blah, blah, blah. He follows, though, the same rules as your exorcists in the Catholic faith start to come. You need to know its name.
Mm.
You need to know what it wants. So it's interesting that it follows these same rules. And the first time we hear Dybbuk used in that negative kind of way is 16th century writings.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's the first time we would kind of see that be used. But it kind of means all sorts of things. Not that demons weren't a thing that was talked about pre-Christ. There's this awesome story with Solomon. I don't know if Solomon wants to make this big temple castle thing. He needs this special mystical worm to come out of this rock, right?
As you do.
And he can't get it out because he's not magical. So he has to get this demon king named Ashmedai.
Okay.
And Ashmedai has like demon legs and normal upper body. But he can also mimic, which is another thing we always see in demons in possession, the ability for mimicry.
You mean like taking on an animal form? I'm not sure what you mean.
No, impersonating voices, impersonating.
Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
And he tricks him essentially by, Solomon has this guy that I always call Benihana, but his name is in my notes. It's Benayahu. Is I just always refer to it as Benihana in my head when I do these readings. So Benihana tricks Ashmedai and makes him get really wasted. And so then Ashmedai is like wasted. And then Solomon like captures him and keeps him as a pet. So he gets the magical worm to make the temple that he wants to make. But then he's like, I kind of like having this guy around.
Yeah. Genie in a bottle.
Yeah. Right. So he keeps him, but it doesn't work out well for Solomon because then Ashmedai like tricks Solomon into giving up his ring. And then Ashmedai pretends to be Solomon for quite a while, and Solomon's out being poor on the streets. People kind of start to think something's up when Solomon's wives start saying, like, listen, Solomon wants to do crazy shit in bed. And this seems strange. And I never see Solomon's legs anymore. Isn't this strange? And then they find out that's Ashmedai.
Wow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And Solomon's like telling everybody, hey, I'm Solomon. They're like, no, you're not.
And he's covering up his legs.
Yeah.
Not revealing his demon legs.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's funny. He's like the little kids and little rascals on each other's shoulders. Like, I'm a perfectly normal person.
I'm totally fine. I just like to do really crazy shit in bed.
You know me.
And keep my legs covered.
You think you know me. A demon under the sheets.
So we don't have possession of people by demons, but rather demons coming out like tempting people in the Old Testament.
Okay, in the style of the devil.
And they can't do anything. They're bound by a set of rules. They can't do anything that God doesn't want them to do.
Huh. So are they serving God's will by sort of people's faith? Challenging faith, rather?
Yeah, and we learn from certain parts of Job's story, they can't do anything that God doesn't want them to do in the first place.
That's interesting.
It's a neat idea. There's always all these kind of rules that they love to break all the time, but it's interesting to see it. And we also have a story of Saul in the book of Samuel, and God sends a demon to go fuck with him for quite a while, too. So, like, usually in the Old Testament, you see them not possessing people, but just, like, poking them in the eye.
Right. I remember when I talked about Under the Shadow, the Iranian horror movie, and in that case, the jinn is also one of these spirits that it's sort of following the same rules as humankind.
Right.
And so it is sort of bound by, you know, God's word, so to speak. And yeah, I mentioned as far as the different cultures, there are listings for exorcisms in terms of Buddhist culture, Hindu culture, Islam, and Judaism, which we're talking about as it sort of originates in the Kabbalah. In terms of exercising these extra spiritual presences, I don't know what we want to call them, in Jewish exorcisms, they're traditionally performed by a rabbi who has mastered practical Kabbalah. So this is a lot more than just the red bracelet and, you know, warding off the evil eye. So around the possessed would stand 10 adult males in a circle around the possessed person. The group recites Psalm 91
three times, and then the rabbi blows the shofar. The shofar is blown in a certain way with various notes and tones, in effect, to, quote, shatter the body. I don't know if you've ever heard a shofar. You've done, like, services and singing cantor-style stuff. And the shofar is just, it's a ram's horn that doesn't really have a musicality to it.
No, it's just noise.
It's, yeah. So, shocking, if you're not expecting it, if in this case you are a possessed person in the middle of 10 men.
Yeah, it's quite a surprise when you hear it out of the blue.
It's like, oh, I didn't know this was going to be a sing-along. What is that, B flat?
I imagine it's very similar to what we do in the shadows when they're playing. They're playing like they're in that band that they're playing, and it's just nonsense.
After the possessing force has been shaken loose, the rabbi begins to communicate with it and ask it questions such as why it's possessing the body and what does it want, what does it need, all these things in order to make it feel safe and so that it can leave the person's body. Okay, so a little creepy, just in the curious game of theological telephone that plays out, Psalm 91 that the ten men recount three times in that process, it was quoted by the devil in both the books of Matthew and Luke, and as it regarded the temptation of Christ. So this is the first part of Psalm 91, starting with verses 11 and 12. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. They will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. You will tread on the lion and the cobra. You will trample the great lion and the serpent. Because he loves me, says the Lord, I will recuse him. I will protect him, for he acknowledges my name. He will call on me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life, I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. Now, the devil presented that to Jesus as a taunt, and in that conversation, he was sort of challenging Jesus that, like, if you are who you think you are and God has your back, then why don't you jump off the pinnacle of that temple over there?
Right.
And, I mean, you know, the devil's a mischievous guy, but that is fucking dark and creepy. And when the devil's telling you back scripture, like, that is unsettling.
You're like, hey there. You know what's so funny about those kind of, some of those temptations, and you see it with Herod being like, well, just kind of do this stuff and I'll let you go. And then the devil's like, do this thing and I'll quit bothering you. And you want to say, well, Jesus wasn't one for showboating, but that's absolutely not true.
No, Jesus,
loved to showboat.
Way more dynamic than we kind of give him credit for.
Like, right.
He wasn't the first. But, like, Jesus was an exorcist.
It's like
he
got bored, fighting. Though.
There are some really cool images, renderings of and relative to Psalm 91 as far as, like, Jesus stepping over a lion and a snake, which often gets called, like, a dragon in different cases. But whatever, they were snakes. But so that image has Jesus standing over the animals holding a cross. Oftentimes the bottom end of that cross is sharpened like a spear.
Right.
Like he is a, you know, he's going to, you know, take down these creatures by any means, like whether, you know, using the power of God or just this fucking spike.
Exactly. Something will make it happen. It's funny when you think about Jesus as an exorcist. In modern day, interesting, Pope John Paul II had participated in exorcisms. And they said, I read this article on Newsweek from 92 as I was digging through the library, that he actually was giving exorcisms. Do you give exorcisms? I perform them. He was performing exorcisms clear as he was Pope too.
No, really?
Yeah, that's what they said. I mean, this Newsweek article. But it's kind of interesting to think about that. But Jesus as an exorcist is an interesting idea. Depending on how you want to interpret the Bible, if you want to interpret it literally, then great, good times, right? We have Mark telling most of the stories of demonic possession and Jesus healing people. Mark was really into possessions.
And, well, the miracles.
Yeah. So then we also have Matthew and Luke on the lower sides, but John doesn't really talk about it. Why isn't John, if he was there?
He's the skeptic.
Talking about it, right?
He's the guy who's like, there's got to be a scientific explanation.
Well, that would probably be Peter, honestly, but John, he's just along for the ride, and he doesn't mention this at all, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke are all about it, mostly. Mark loves to talk about it.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting, these ideas. These people sometimes, it's seemingly through history, get like really obsessed with exorcism, certain religious people.
I read that there was a surge in the 20th century, mm-hmm. as far as the calls for and mm-hmm. exorcisms performed, and that's
it's
Vatican
a blowback.
Too.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real blowback, I think, to modern psychiatry and psychoanalysis. So you know, you have Freud and Jung, and then people saying, "Well, that's still not helping me." And looking for, I think, alternative solutions.
Wow. There's an interesting idea as far as, like, the Catholic Church trying to maintain their place as far as, like, you know, people's well-being across the board, mental right. health is included.
The thing that gets a little, I don't know about that, is that if you are a Christian and you read the Bible as if it is this set of rules, you should know that no Christian can be possessed.
We talked about this a little bit as it related to the show Outcast, yeah. and they are in a Baptist culture.
Right.
And so anyone in, like, the Protestant wing of Christianity, we talked about how the body as a vessel really only has space for right. one occupant spirit at a time.
Exactly. 1 Corinthians tells us the body is dead. What animates it is the Holy Spirit. So there's only room for one.
Wow.
So that's kind of a neat idea when you go to watch The Exorcist or something like that. You're like, hey, there's no room for two.
Starting us off with the two films on possession, we're going to be covering The Possession from 2012.
I love a good exorcism and possession.
I rewatched this, like, this morning, rewatched and really exciting.
Like, I like this, it. There are some good things about this movie.
It did reasonably well, but this is a movie that deserves a lot more credit.
You know what the problem was? It came out 2012 Fright Fest. Mm. It was on the same day as, like, American Mary, which okay. is an excellent film.
Yeah, yeah.
It came out in the same festival as Grabbers VHS. So it had so many things yeah. that it was competing against. I think that's why it got a little bit lost in the shuffle.
So this one was produced by Ghost House Pictures, Sam Raimi's horror outfit.
Yeah.
And directed by Ole Bornedal, who directed 1997's Night Watch, not related to the Date Watch trilogy.
No, though. This is the Ewan McGregor one.
It was a remake of his own film from 1994, and he hasn't done much other mm-hmm. English language stuff.
I was kind of surprised.
To this specifically. Yeah. Written by Juliet Snowden and Stiles White. That's a name. They're a husband and wife couple who write as a team.
White and Snowden? They're the White Snowden family.
The White Snowden family. Yeah. It almost sounds like some Game of Thrones shit. They together wrote Boogeyman, the Nick Cage movie, Knowing, and 2014's Ouija. Mm-hmm. I thought it pretty cool. An early draft of this was written by E.L. Katz.
I'd be interested in that.
Yeah, from early Adam Wingard history. And in his own right, he wrote and directed Cheap Thrills, which is awesome. But in any case, The Possession.
Hi.
Hey.
You're late.
Kiddo, you ready to go? I'll have him back Sunday after lunch.
Just healthy food, okay? No pizza?
I'll give you $5 if you don't tell your mother.
Make it 35.
Dad, you need dishes.
Dad, look! Look!
I'm a lady.
Cool.
Daddy, can I get this?
Whatever you want, kiddo.
There's something in there.
Well, that's weird. There aren't any seams.
What does that mean?
I think whoever made this didn't want anybody to open it.
Stars Negan, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, being very charming in this.
Yeah,
very
he's a little charming. Heavier. He's a little, yeah.
Different. It's different. It's a few years ago, you know. Kira Sedgwick, who I love to see, and she's playing, you know, kind of like a bitch, and I kind of like that. I like her that way.
I thought she was just a protective mom, but okay.
Okay, fine. Natasha Callis, one of the kids. Grant Cho from, what was that show? I always think of it was like 90210, but for adults.
That's Melrose Place?
Yes, that's what Grant Show came from. Madison Davenport, and then a special guest appearance by Modest Yahoo.
Yeah, the reggae sensation. Yeah, from my neighborhood, apparently, Crown yeah. Heights. He's not, I don't think he's there anymore, but in any case, yeah, Modest Yahoo was, at the time, he was a Jewish guy in the Hasidic faith, and you could, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. The visuals are very specific, so he was, like, not going to be confused for anyone else. And it was a big deal that he was starring in this movie. And he's appeared in a couple other movies and documentaries.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, he's a performer through and through. Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, I think these days he doesn't recognize as Hasidic specifically.
I see.
But he still is a Jewish man of faith. So, yeah, you mentioned Natasha Callis, She's the possessed.
Yes.
She reminded me a lot of Anna Paquin. She is really good for as young as she is.
She's very good because it is night and day when you have these possession moments and then these like regular girl moments.
Yeah. And not even, I mean, when we talk about the possession, it's never, you know, we're going to talk about Reagan later in The Exorcist, but it's a different style. It's a different thing happening entirely. We'll talk about the Dybbuk in a moment, but that she shows like a pretty impressive spectrum.
Yeah.
For, you know, what she's probably like a 12, 13 year old girl. Like, it's a pretty impressive range.
I talked to my friend.
Your friend?
What?
You said you talked to your friend.
Mm-hmm. The one who lives in the box.
Your friend lives inside the box?
What?
He lives in there?
It's a she. A woman.
Okay, here's a brief synopsis from IMDb. A young girl buys an antique box at a yard sale, unaware that inside the collectible lives a malicious ancient spirit. The girl's father teams with his ex-wife to find a way to end the curse upon their child. So, yeah, that's a bare bones.
Yeah.
That's what happens. But
the best thing is that this is based on a true story.
A true manipulated story.
Totally manipulated story. Because I got so excited, I started looking into it. And I had remembered kind of reading this on Gawker in 2012, but then it put it out of my mind because it wasn't interesting. It's like most things. When you find the true story of it, you're like, oh, that wasn't so interesting.
Yeah, there are texts early in the movie that claim that this is a true story based on a family's experience. And,
yeah.
Playing fast and loose there.
Yeah, very fast and loose. The only thing that kind of like they, you know, he made up this story to sell this freaking cabinet.
Yeah.
That's the whole freaking point. And the reason that Jason Haxton gets this, buys it from eBay in the first place is because of this crazy story.
Right, right. It was, yeah, it was creepypasta by way of an eBay purchase.
Yeah. It used to be that way. They used to have things like that on eBay, and it was kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny to think that, like, they were using the internet traditionally like a means to often, well, I was going to say dispel weird beliefs. Or indulge them entirely as it relates to fake news.
Exactly. So the Dybbuk box was just like a wine box.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's with some carvings. Magic. With some carvings on it.
It's just not that exciting when you really like take it apart. In this though, it contains some really cool shit. There's a tooth in there, why not? Some hair in there.
Yeah.
A bunch of moths.
Horse figure and or cow. There are interesting stories in the Bible about cows being possessed, but that's not what this.
No.
It was just a little. It was a toy. Yeah. It was a child's
toy. Right,
right,
right.
Yeah. When Jeffrey Dean Morgan does, you know, go to the next up professional and sort of have someone explain what the box is, this is already after a number of things have happened, but he explains to him that it's Polish. It goes back to, I think he said, like 1922.
Okay.
So this was the belonging of a person who, you know, I think that's when the history starts to get a little fuzzy as far as like the intention. I don't know the reality of Dybbuk boxes, but the idea of imprisoning a spirit that traditionally, quote, clings.
Yes, it's true.
To other souls. Yeah, I don't know. I like it as a concept. The sort of
it's an interesting concept. Doesn't actually have to do. I mean, well, I was going to say it doesn't have to do with the facts, but it doesn't have to do with the thought of interpreting scripture as fact. It actually doesn't make any goddamn sense. No sense whatsoever being happened there.
Yeah,
because even Solomon to contain demons had a magic ring. It wasn't that he put him in a little box. You know what I'm saying?
One ring to rule them all.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Why is there this mirror? If the spirit was contained, it would have to look upon itself to be forever reminded that it turned away from God.
Jesus. Abizu. Taker of children.
The whole idea of the box being inhabited by a Dybbuk is nonsensical according to what a Dybbuk is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. The Encyclopedia Mythica describes it as a disembodied spirit possessing a living body that belongs to another soul and usually talks from that person's mouth. An important 1914 Yiddish play, The Dybbuk, was about the spirit of a dead man who possessed the living body of the woman he had loved and had to be exorcised.
It's kind of cool in this film, the way that they show the possession. So we have the Dybbuk possessing the little girl in this case. There is a scene with an MRI that I think is the coolest freaking thing I've seen on film. It's like so smart. It's so cool. You can see the ghost inside the person and it's awesome.
What's MRI, magnetic resonance imaging?
I don't really know if it's an MRI or an EKG. I don't know what the difference is. Yeah, I know it's not an EKG. That's like for hearts.
So actually, well, speaking of the Dybbuk, a long time ago, you found a box here in the office was like unmarked. Was
locked.
It padlocked? How was it locked?
There's just like a lock built into it.
Okay.
No keys.
Like a number? But it required a key to open,
yes.
And that was what was gone. So wait, so you cracked it open? No, you never opened it.
I unscrewed it. I did. That's the thing. Don't ever think I'm responsible enough to be like, don't look into that box or something bad will happen. Because if you tell me that, I'm going to take a screwdriver and open it up.
You've got the self-control of a child. That's why you don't have like a Ouija board in your home, because you don't want to tempt fate to like...
Exactly.
Even like, you know, of course I'm going to play it. It was in my home.
Of course. Like, I have no self-control over that. There was no Dybbuk in there. It was actually completely empty. So maybe there was and it's out. Maybe I'm possessed. Maybe you're talking to a Dybbuk right now.
I think our listenership should take a bump for that. If I'm doing a live podcast with a possessed person, that's a first.
Yeah, right. I don't know. There was nothing in the box, so maybe there was, and now it's here.
Do you still keep the box under your desk?
Yes, I do. I rest my feet on it, but I do have a sign to just like ward off people from stealing it and put their feet on it. And it says Dybbuk, don't open.
And now it's on a piece of paper. Written Dybbuk, don't open.
Yeah,
I love that it'll send whoever is cleaning up this place when it's completely empty and this isn't a company anymore is going to have to Google what that is.
They're going to think it is too. That's the best part, because I screwed it back together.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I locked that shit back up. They're going to think there's a Dybbuk in there. Yeah, I rest my feet on it, but I just don't want anyone to take it. So I just keep that idea that there is a Dybbuk in there so everyone stays away.
So going back to the idea of the scares in the movie, I was so thoroughly impressed that they, in places where your standard run-of-the-mill movie would just kind of raise the music and give you the jump scare, the movie does, I mean, it's got quote-unquote jump scares at times, but they are so well choreographed.
Yeah, I don't mind them.
The lead-ups and even the, like, cool-down periods are fascinating. That, like, it's... You know, this isn't a bloody movie. This was a PG-13 movie. Like,
that's interesting. I didn't even realize. I think it's scary as hell, though.
Yeah, when I saw it, I had to do the, like, you know, sort of mental Rolodex of, like, blood, murder. There's not written, no, there's a little bit of foul language, but barely that.
You're right.
It's, it is a relatively clean movie you could watch with your kids. But
maybe you could.
The scares are so well executed. I was really thrilled with this, that, like, from top to bottom. And so... One of my notes that I was most excited for and sort of binds these two movies is the style of editing at play.
Mm-hmm.
In The Exorcist, which I had watched before rewatching The Possession, I did take note that there are incredibly dramatic, scary moments in The Exorcist that are quickly cut from and cut away to like the normalcy of life, or just like normal people trying to make heads or tails of what they just experienced. But we don't indulge in those scary moments, those tense moments where like the music's going. You know, a modern day movie would spend a couple minutes in that scene until you're exhausted.
Right.
I found it serves when cutting away from the action, it sort of, you know, it teases you. It gives you a little bit here and there. And it always reminds you that this is happening to normal, logical, rational people. And then later, when just all hell breaks loose and those same rational people are having to deal with like some decidedly irrational shit, like you are there with them.
I think honestly, if I had to say one thing that might deter people from watching this one in particular, it is that quick editing.
Oh, really?
Because it's just suddenly like, it's almost like made for TV. And suddenly it's just like, boom, we're done now, commercial. And there's like one fade to black that I just despise. It's so commercial. I mean, I get it. And once you watch the entire film, you go, oh, okay. You know, I don't mind it. But when you're kind of in it, I didn't love the quick cuts. Because it was just suddenly like, what? Oh, okay. I guess we're doing this now. And I like to languish in in the scary shit. I like to live there. Don't take it away from me.
Raise my heart rate. Maybe it's like what draws you to spinning class. Like, exactly. Raise my heart rate and plateau it. Just leave it
high there
until I fall off.
Right. I'm not going to go for a sprint and then just like hop off my bike and walk away. Right. I don't know. That was the one thing that I would say. Like, but I don't know how you would change it. I don't think you would and still have the same film. So I guess you have to leave it. It's just something that irritated me.
I think in a lot of these scenes, what is missing is the like parental soothing mm-hmm. that would happen, because Jeffrey Dean Morgan's witness to a couple incidents and
right, but what the follows, parents are very stunted anyway. They're doing their own thing.
Well, but not so detached that they wouldn't comfort like a frightened kid. And so I think that we never get that comforting moment with the kids also leaves we, the viewer, at edge and unsettled mm-hmm. and unresolved until the end, like I said, where things explode.
Yeah. Not literally. I don't know. Part of me thinks like, I don't know. It's a 92-minute film. And I feel like some of that wasn't on purpose. It was just to be like, we got a story to tell you guys. Oh, we got to go.
I thought it was so deliberate. I thought it was definitely a nod to the style of The Exorcist. Mm. But I got more reading to do.
I personally think that's really gross, because they sweep the hair into these bins and then they weigh them and then they take them to the special place where they maneuver them into like these wigs. And I mean,
I'm sorry, Daddy. I'm sorry, Daddy. I'm really sorry.
Relatively early into the possession, where Emily is behaving strangely, and the binge eating component was so creepy.
Yes.
But so one of the early scenes of that, she's just chowing down on some pancakes and mm-hmm. she is going after them hard enough to like scrape the plate.
I used to eat like that as a kid.
Okay, so I was going to ask you coming up in a moment, because Jeffrey Dean Morgan tells her, sweetie, slow down. And when he eventually does reach over to her plate, she stabs him in the hand with her fork. And it's a vague memory, but you've got a story about someone being stabbed in the hand with
a
fork.
My dad did that. My dad did that to his brother at dinner. The first time he brought my mom home to meet my great-grandparents, they were having dinner. And my great-grandparents loved like fancy dinner. You would have nice dinner. And so his brother was invited.
Your salad fork, your dinner fork,
very
and your
fancy.
Stabbing fork.
Exactly. It was probably an oyster fork. It seems small for your hands.
Yeah,
but I guess my uncle reached over to get something instead of asking. And so we're big on manners in my family.
No kidding.
And so because he displayed bad manners, my dad stabbed him with the fork. But I suppose he probably learned manners after that. Right? We're really big on manners.
Wow. In her case, she was possessed. Your dad had no excuse. No. That is just violent.
He was possessed by Miss Manners. Yeah, that was like, oh, welcome home to, you know, I don't think they were engaged. They were just dating at the time. But my mom, for some reason, like came back for more. I don't know why. Right.
They take manners really seriously. In that house.
Like,
I'm
have
into
such
it.
Good manners.
Can I have some more?
She's still hungry.
While promoting the film on Craig Ferguson, Jeffrey Dean Morgan told a story about creepy shit happening on set.
Uh-huh.
And so The Exorcist, we'll get into it, but The Exorcist famously had like a number of issues on set, and people read into all sorts of mm-hmm. creepy happenings. But in this case, like some legit creepy shit happened in front of the cast.
Oh, freaky stuff did happen, and I don't... All right, I'm going to tell you guys the story.
Okay. All right. Who's all right. the lady in the movie?
Well, my wife, ex-wife, is Kira Sedgwick, and then there's two girls in it, Natasha Collis and Madison Davenport. And Natasha Collis plays the little demon, the Antichrist, as it were.
Yeah.
And she's super freaky.
Yeah.
Not in real life, but in movie life.
Is there a difference?
No. I mean, 11-year-old girl, they're all kind of Antichrist, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the deal? But so, okay, the weird stuff.
No, that wasn't weird enough for you.
Yeah,
okay.
No, key lights exploding, like, only during, like, kind of big scenes.
Really?
Yeah, and it happened, like, three or four times. I've done a lot of... So lights would explode in the middle of scenes, and then we're in a closed studio like this, and all of a sudden, like, a cold wind gust would come through with no doors open, no fan. I'm not making the
crack up.
Okay, so, and what else? Oh, all the props burned down. We put all of our stuff in storage after the movie in case you have to do reshoots, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, 2 days later, they were in a storage facility after we wrapped, and it burned to the ground, and it was investigated, and it wasn't arson, it wasn't electrical fire, and it started from within.
I know.
So I can't recommend this movie enough. I really, really enjoyed this.
I liked it a lot.
And it's, like you said, it's short. It's sweet. It's really, I mean, it's not blood and guts horror. It's just really great mood building. The mm-hmm. actors, everybody in this is killing it. It's so good. And yeah, I wish old Bornedal would do more, or I should look into his Dutch films, perhaps.
Yeah, I guess. It wasn't to say that it wasn't successful, so I don't understand why you never hear about it. Even in the horror community, we don't talk about it.
Yeah, I think it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Just calling itself The Possession, there's like 7 movies
right.
with a similar, if not that, title.
Right.
So yeah, so this is the 2012 Jeffrey Dean Morgan, The Possession. So that'll close us out. We are on all the social media outlets, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and you can drop us a line. Our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. We're on Patreon. So yeah, that's us on Patreon, where you can join us for a whole separate catalog of shows, of music, of sketches. A lot is waiting for you on Patreon, and we could use the support.
So check out our website. We are therantsmacabre.com, where you can also stream our show. There's other stuff and things on there, and there's a donate button. What? Check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, everything you can download podcasts on. We're on it.
Yeah.
If you're on iTunes and finding us through there, leave us some stars. I love stars.
Give
I eat them for
review.
Breakfast.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.